So, dear friends, dear colleagues, I'm very glad to be here again. As I promised yesterday, I have no tie. I hope I look more Californian today. Today, I would like to talk about transformations of European security architecture after the Cold War. For the first view, this topic is absolutely not interconnected with the presentation and lecture of Dr. Rozhansky. But I think that in depth, it has a lot of interconnections because I would like to explain you not only processes which took place in 1990s, especially in Eastern Europe and in relations between Russia, the United States, Russia and NATO, but also how these processes have been perceived by Russian officials, by Russian political elite and by Russian society. It's a complicated task, so I'm sorry that I didn't make any presentation, a PowerPoint presentation today, because I think that this topic requires more attention to historic details than to analytical schemes. I always use PowerPoint presentations for analytical figures, tables and schemes. And I would like to use it tomorrow. And I promise that I will, because I have been asked by Anna Borisovna to speak Russian tomorrow, because it can be useful for your skills of Russian language. Today, unfortunately, I have prepared my lecture in English. I didn't know that I should speak in Russian, but tomorrow I will have pictures in English, and I will speak in Russian. Okay, I will try to combine because lecture I have prepared for tomorrow has been prepared by, also in English, so doesn't matter. The end of the Cold War, the period when a lot of elements we are seeing now in the international system and which are existing as norms, institutions, practices, all of them have been emerging from the previous system, and they had very strong impact of the Cold War system of international relations. Very strong impact of psychology I have described, psychology of elites on both sides. I have described yesterday. And the development of these elements of new international order, including new European security architecture, included a lot of controversial and ambivalent trends in the development of international system of previous periods, and sometimes the influence, the impact which the inertia of Cold War legacy had on the development of structures, norms, institutions, and principles of new security architecture, including new European security architecture, was extremely high. And the legacy of previous era in this sense is still high, is still very high today. Sometimes we do not even notice the extent of influence of the previous understanding of previous world order and previous understanding of international relations and relations between NATO countries and Soviet Union, NATO countries and Warsaw Pact on current day situation and current day processes. It has started with a first period of transformations which to my mind has lasted from 1989 when revolutions in former socialist states has started, till 1992. I think it matches with the period of George Bush senior administration, and especially during this period, a lot of you know, decisions, a lot of approaches, a lot of you know, concepts have appeared. And all these ideas, approaches, concepts are still living and still influencing on the understanding of European security and understanding of you know, nature of relations between Russia and NATO, between Russia and former socialist countries, former members of Warsaw Pact, and some former Soviet republics. George Bush administration has been faced with four significant tasks in their European transatlantic foreign policy agenda. First one, to respond on Soviet peaceful initiatives and to keep the process of you know, disarmament and the development of arms control norms and institutions in general and also in Europe going in any case of political of development of political situation inside Soviet Union. This was very significant task because in many ways, Soviet Union has been entering into serious crisis, economic, social, political, which could cause any reactions of Soviet government and any changes in the foreign policy agenda, which could be sometimes risky for interests of the United States and for allies of the United States. Well, it was perceived like this by Washington, by Brussels, by major European capitals. Everybody understood that military capabilities that degrading Soviet system still had were more than enough to you know, to use it in not only in Europe but also on the larger or even global scale, and the possibility of military conflict, for example, Robert Gates is writing about it in his memories, for perception, for understanding of motives and goals of Soviet government was significant for American intelligence community and for intelligence and decision-making community of NATO countries. Everybody were afraid of a new form of reaction from coming from collapsing Soviet Union and the possibilities of use of force. Soviet troops were standing in eastern Germany. Warsaw Pact was degrading but still existing until 1991. And for George Bush Sr., the most significant thing was to find a way to keep the dialogue which Mikhail Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan have started about European security, about international security in general, going, and in any case of political developments in Soviet Union. In that time, for Soviet Union, because I understand it because of reading of many memoirs of Soviet leaders and Soviet officials of that period, for Soviet Union, the opportunity of any military conflict with the West was absolutely impossible, because Soviet Union was highly dependent on credits highly dependent on programs of aid coming, financial also, and the other forms of aid coming from Western countries. Soviet Union was disorganized politically, and the parade of sovereignties, as we call it, has started, because Baltic states were the first, but a lot of other former Soviet republics were very close to, in that time, were very close to become separate states. The Warsaw Pact was eclipsing, and nobody really believed in the obligations which Warsaw Pact members had. Second task which George Bush administration had concerning European security was the task of keeping US leadership in Europe. Because, you know, in case Warsaw Pact was eclipsing, military political situation in Europe has been changing. The risk of, of degradation for Euro-Atlantic security community and, degradation of NATO as military political bloc was not very high, but possible. And for the United States, one of the principal tasks was to keep American leadership and to sustain the activity of NATO as a military political bloc and as political organization. Third very significant task interconnected with previous two was to resolve the Germany issue, and to resolve it in the way which can allow Germany to become not only united, but united under the auspices of Euro-Atlantic security community. And this was one of the most significant tasks. There were different approaches to the resolution of Germany issue, and I'm sure that you have read about it a lot. But there were suggestions for different scenarios of the reunification of Germany, and different visions of possible, relations between united Germany and military political blocs in Eastern Europe, in Europe. For example, Soviet government tried to suggest different scenarios, and one of them, it sounds ridiculous right now, but one of them suggested for Germany to be at the same time member of Warsaw Pact and member of NATO. If Warsaw Pact could exist, it could be something very significant for changing the whole security environment in Europe, and building bridges between Warsaw Pact and NATO. But of course, it's wishful thinking, and it's something like, even in that time, it was not a very practical idea, because Soviet Union, together with the United States, supported from the beginning the idea of reunification of Germany, because it wanted to have support from, economic support from Western Germany, and it wanted to have ties with united Germany in economic, technological, and other spheres. That's very rational motivation. I want to remind you that on the initial phase of debate about Germany reunification, do you remember who was against reunification inside Western community?
Thatcher.
Sorry?
Margaret Thatcher.
Margaret Thatcher, absolutely. And François Mitterrand also. French and Britain. They were against of Germany reunification. But after that, after some time, both French and British governments supported the idea. And but it has been realized by the scenario which has been supported by the United States, but with help and with agreement with Soviet government. Soviet government wanted guarantees of non-alignment of United Germany and of its neutral status. The United States refused. Soviet government asked for guarantees for for NATO military infrastructure not to go further in case of Germany reunification and not to be moved to the Eastern Germany instead of Soviet and Eastern German military infrastructure. But American government didn't give any written guarantees, and there were only talks and some obligations on words, which Mikhail Gorbachev and some of people from his inner circle are mentioning in their memoirs. But there are no improvements. There are no documents at all. Only documents. Only recording of talks they had with American representatives, but it's nothing in terms of international law. Fourth significant task which George Bush senior administration has faced was interconnected with fate of Eastern European countries, their future political, economic development and possible models of interaction between them and the Western community. For many, there were a lot of debates in that time about future of these countries and their relationship with North Atlantic Alliance, with Western structures and Western community. There were a lot of experts, even in the United States and in Western European country, who were suggesting natural status for them. But discussion which took place in 1990 and 1990 from 1990 till 1992 was mostly focused on the idea of finlandization or austerization of these countries. But I think that from 1990 another approach to this question appeared in not only in expert community but also in political community, and I think it has started to dominate very soon, and I think in the end of 1992 the answer to the question what will happen with Eastern European countries, especially with so-called Visegrad group countries. Can you remind me who were in the Visegrad group?
Poland.
Slovakia. No, Slovakia joined it later. Czech Republic, Poland and Hungary. And but the dominating approach was based on the idea that they should be integrated into Western security community and Euro-Atlantic security structures. 1990 was a very special year for not only for transatlantic relations but for the emergence of a new understanding of European security architecture. In 1990, I want to remind you, two very significant documents have been signed. And one of them you will read for your seminar, for your simulation on Friday. It was Paris Charter for the New Europe. And another one was Conventional Armed Forces Treaty in Europe, CFE Treaty. Both of them were significant for new relations between still existing Warsaw Pact and NATO. But none of them really responded to the challenges that both sides have faced 1 or 2 years after it. Both of these documents have been prepared as documents of status quo. Both of them were taking into account situation which existed in that moment. But their offers, they couldn't and they predict, and they didn't predict, of course, the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1 year, but it was very close one. They didn't and couldn't predict, of course they could, but they didn't, the collapse of Warsaw Pact in 1 year, in less than 1 year. They were not ready to the situation when on the place of the Soviet Union a lot of sovereign new states could appear, and Russia could become the country which is having driving initiative in the process of divergence of Soviet Union. That's very significant. Situation of the beginning of 1990s was also significant not only for the future of Eastern European countries, but also for NATO itself, like a military political bloc. And the community which is giving guarantees to its members and having the major player in the face of United States in terms of military power, and a group of countries which are giving guarantees to the major player, but major player at the same time giving guarantees, security guarantees to them. There were several risks for existing NATO, and there were also a point of bifurcation, a sort of point of bifurcation for the development of alliance. What have been marked as principal risks for the future of NATO and for development of the bloc? I think there were two significant risks. The first risk, which expert community in that time marked, was a risk of renationalization of security policies of European members of NATO. Everybody, especially in Washington, but also in the European capitals and in Brussels, they were afraid that further development of NATO will be more interconnected with political activities, with political consultations, and with the agenda which has been developing since the report of Armel in 1968, and would be more interconnected with non-military security risks. At the same time, a lot of people were thinking that renationalization of security policies of especially European NATO members can put in a risk the obligations they have to each other, and the coordinating role of North Atlantic Alliance as the institution and as the body organizing and coordinating military activities of this country. So a lot of people were afraid that that Germany, United Germany, France, Great Britain and other members of NATO will be more concentrated in the situation when the military threat of Soviet expansion is reducing, will be more concentrated on their own military programs, on they will try to reduce military spendings, and will not play the role they should play according to Washington Treaty towards other NATO members. Second risk was interconnected with fears which many experts and politicians in Washington and Brussels had about possibility that European security and military political integration will go separate from Euro-Atlantic security guarantees and structures, and could become a process which would develop without decisive role of the United States and without obligations which NATO countries are having towards each other according to NATO according to North Atlantic Treaty. And European integration in the military political sphere could reduce the significance of NATO as an organizing body for the community. So the further development of processes inside NATO and in relations between between NATO and Russia, and also between NATO and the former socialist countries, disapproved all these fears, and it followed the line which reduced all these risks to minimum. First of all, it was NATO strategic concept of 1991, which tried to suggest formula for both relations with former socialist countries, which were looking for the new model of interaction with the Western community and NATO. And second, it suggested that European integration should, in the security sphere, should become a European pillar of transatlantic integration and development of transatlantic community. So, strategic concept of alliance of 1991 suggested this ambivalent decision for both risks, and at the same time it suggested a model of relations between NATO and emerging new countries on post-socialist and post-Soviet space. It was idea of cooperation of different speeds. So they suggested the idea of different models of cooperations, cooperation which could be suggested for former socialist countries, members of Warsaw Pact, and for socialist former Soviet republics, and could give background for finding for each of them an adequate model of interaction, of cooperation, and in the future for integration. At the same time, the new process of after the collapse of the Soviet Union and after the new Russia has appeared on the geopolitical landscape, the process of interaction, the new relations between NATO and Russia has started, and they were very different in their nature from in the beginning, from the relations with Soviet Union. It gave birth to the idea of differentiated partnership, and which gave background for partnership for peace program in 1994, And the idea of different speeds of cooperation led to idea of different speeds of integration into Western security community. What was happening in Russia in that time? Russian political system was going through a deep and, you know, sometimes very dangerous phase of its development. It was absolutely unstable. Russian economy collapsed from the beginning because the Soviet economy was in a deep crisis since 1988, and at the same time, this system was absolutely unprepared for market reforms, which new Russian government have started in a very radical form, because nobody knew how to move this command and control, a mobilized economy with a higher role of military-industrial complex towards norms, principles, and models of market economy and based on private enterprise. So Russian political and economic system was going through the way of disasters. And I want to remind you that in 1993, the attempt to change the model of development in the country, and discussions on political level about the model of development of the country, led to the direct conflict between parliament and president. And Russian President Boris Yeltsin used military force against parliament and bombed parliament with tanks, and it was sort of a street battle in Moscow. I saw it with my own eyes. I was 14 years old in that time, and I was riding bicycle and looking at soldiers standing in the streets, and it's something. It's impression I will never forget. But this situation serious crisis of Russian federal system, together with problems in many republics inside Russian Federation, didn't give opportunity for the Western community to take Russia serious. It didn't give an opportunity, and I understand in many ways approach of Western capitals and decision makers in the United States and in other NATO countries towards Russia in that time, because situation there, domestic political situation, was absolutely unstable. Russia has been dependent in that time on highly dependent on Western credits and Western financial flows, which from time to time came from both London Club of Creditors, Paris Club of Creditors, and from international financial institutions. And at the same time, the domestic political problems, the rise of ethnic nationalism in many republics of Russian Federation, which was continuing the line which have been started by ethnic nationalism as a driving force for the divergation of the Soviet Union, was very significant problem. In 1994, I want to remind you the situation in Northern Caucasus led to the direct conflict between federal government and regional government of Republic of Chechnya, which tried to declare independence and which tried to use very tough practices of ethnical approach towards Russian minority in that region, and concentrated a lot of weapons, and what happened, you remember the war in Chechnya, terrible disaster for both Russia and Chechnya, which caused many victims on both sides, and took a lot of forces, economic, military, financial forces from Russian government, and even made political situation in Russia more complicated. In this situation, Clinton's government, the Clinton's administration, which has been elaborating and developing new approach towards Euro-Atlantic security, preferred not to take into account any positions of Moscow and any contradictions which Russia had with emerging new states on its borders, including, of course, Ukraine and other states. What Clinton administration did, and which was very significant for the status of new Russia and for international security in general, and for a situation in Eastern Europe, and in Europe in general, was the decision to support Russia as the only succeeder for the Soviet Union in terms of nuclear forces and nuclear legacy. It was a very significant issue of Soviet nuclear weapons, which have been concentrated in four republics of former Soviet Union. It was who can name these republics? Kazakhstan, yes.
Belarus,
Ukraine, and one more.
Russian
Federation. Clinton administration played a significant role, and before that, Bush administration has started this work, but it was Clinton's administration who supported Russia as the only broker and keeper and stakeholder of Soviet nuclear forces. Two countries gave their nuclear forces they also had strategic and tactical nukes to Russia easily. Who it was? Kazakhstan and Belarus. And which country didn't want to give nukes to Russia? Ukraine. And my older colleagues, people who have been involved into the talks with Ukrainian military, together with Americans in that period, about the future of Soviet nuclear potential and its elements situated in Ukraine, told me that Ukrainian military, who really understood the stakes of this situation and risks, especially after Chernobyl, which Matt Ruzhansky has mentioned today, they were very, very flexible and very ready for compromises. Who were not? The new political elite, especially people in the Ukrainian parliament in Rada, and a lot of people in political and in political community, who were insisting that Ukraine should have nuclear forces to protect itself, to become a member, even member of Security Council, and to be the new normal nuclear power like Russia and other countries. The paradox is that Ukrainian government in that time was so weak that it was very hard because of domestic political reasons for it to make decisions about this issue. And that's why talks about Ukrainian nukes, it lasted for more than 2 years. And who played the decisive role, do you know, in this process? Ukrainian Academy of Sciences. Because its president, Professor Paton, who is still alive, who is turning 100 years next year, or this year? This year, yes. He insisted strongly that keeping that infrastructure for keeping and serving of this nukes on Ukrainian territory without infrastructure, which Russia has, is impossible. And it is putting Ukrainian environment and Ukrainian society into a big danger, because the nukes should be reloaded every 2 or 3 years. And they were not reloaded since the collapse of the Soviet Union. And they are becoming more and more dangerous day by day. And together with position of the United States, it has influenced on decision-making process in Ukraine. And it helps to resolve this crisis with nuclear weapons. And you know what happened after, and what has been fixed in the Budapest Declaration, and who gave guarantees to Ukraine's sovereignty, and but anyway, the future of NATO, the future of European architecture in this period was so complicated and so unpredictable that the approach which Clinton administration chose for new understanding of the system of partnerships it has been developing with former Soviet republics and Eastern European countries has become one of the cornerstones of the policy which the new security strategy of the United States has has defined as a strategy for enlargement and engagement. So the idea if NATO will expand, and if Western security community will expand, and community of democracy with security guarantees, has been changed with the idea when it will happen, with the question when and how it will happen, and how former Soviet republics could be integrated into this process. Of course, it has started together, this approach has started to develop together with the new understanding of role of NATO and the document which has been issued in 1995 and called the New Transatlantic Agenda gave a background not only for development of cooperation between US and EU. It gave a significant background for development of cooperation between NATO and EU. And it gave also a stimulus, I think it enforced strongly the synchronization of processes of expansion of NATO and enlargement of European Union. That was very significant because it stopped any discussions about the future of European pillar, the future of European security integration. It united two different processes, different by its nature, the development of military political bloc and development of political and economic unity of countries. And it united processes of enlargement of these two different by its nature institutions, communities, and gave hope to Eastern European countries, in the beginning Visegrad countries, but also for others to be integrated at the same time to a European market and to receive investments, trade preferences and everything like that from European Union, and at the same time to receive security guarantees from NATO. But security guarantees against what? Nobody responded openly on this question in that time. You know, if you will look attentively to NATO strategic concept of 1991, you will see one phrase about it, that NATO should prevent any power, any state from dominating on in Europe and from influencing on security and political situation in the region. Russia is not mentioned, but which power can dominate in Europe?
Germany.
That's true. And the idea of integration of the United Germany inside NATO is dating back to the idea of integration of Western Germany into NATO structures in the beginning of the history of this bloc, because it was very significant to keep Germany in, to have guarantees that that Germany will never have a revival of attempt of military political dominance in Europe. But in 1991, Germany was not so significant. It didn't have military power comparable to Russia. It didn't have any ambitions of dominating in Europe. So this idea, this phrase, which has been written in the NATO security strategy, I think it had a long-term goals and has been oriented to prevent any opportunity of Weimar syndrome for Russia, or a revival of Russian military and political dominance in Eastern Europe. But what was happening in Russia in 1990s? I told you about the crisis. I told you about the crisis of 1993 and the threat of complete destabilization of the political system and civil war in Russia. We were very close to civil war. We went just from in one step from civil war, because there were real battles in Moscow, real battles with involvement of hundreds of people, and about 700 of people died in these clashes. What happened after the first phase of war in Chechnya? In 1996, in Russia happened presidential elections, and Boris Yeltsin, who was extremely sick in that time, and who had a lot of problems with his health of different nature, and who had also a lot of a lot of influence on his policy from the group of oligarchs who were controlling major part of the economy and who received a lot of property not by legal means, was facing situation when he could find guarantees of his status and guarantees of his international recognition only by the West, and he could receive this support only by the West, and the West gave him such guarantees and such support. It happened in two forms. First of all, after 1996, Russia has been invited to join G8, which has been G7 in that time, like it is now. But Russia has been invited to join G8, not the financial one, but political one. It was significant for domestic political reasons for Yeltsin's regime, because it showed that he could continue to bring money and bring in not only aid, but possibly investment from the West. And he could also help to integrate modern Russia into Western economic community, and only he can be the guarantee of such integration. Second thing, it gave the document which helped Boris Yeltsin to use it against opposition, which was criticizing his foreign policy strongly. It was NATO-Russia Founding Act, which gave a background for relations and which suggested the framework for new relations between Russia and NATO. Why it was so significant for Boris Yeltsin? Because during 1990s, he tried to be as much benevolent towards the West and his administration, towards the West as he could, because he was cornered with domestic economic and political situation and couldn't play any real independent game. And when I'm talking to my students at MGIMO University, they are asking me sometimes, what do you think about Kozarev's diplomacy? I always, Kozarev was Minister of Foreign Affairs, I always respond for them, to them that it was Yeltsin's diplomacy and it was presidential foreign policy, because in our country, foreign policy is always presidential. Yes, Andrei Kozarev was the person who were representing this approach, this attempt, personally, this attempt to be as much benevolent towards the West as the new Russian system could. But the person who were making decision was, of course, not Kozarev, but Boris Yeltsin. But to keep, opposition not so active and not so actively criticizing him for his decisions, Boris Yeltsin did a very pragmatic political step. He asked Yevgeny Primakov, who had a very special view on foreign policy, on the international system, on the situation in Europe, to be the Minister of Foreign Affairs. And with this person, a lot of new ideas and new approaches towards relations with the West, more pragmatic, more rational, more concentrated on Russian interests, has started. Of course, Primakov didn't have free hands in many questions. He was strongly criticized on the one hand by Boris Yeltsin and his and people around him. He was permanently attacked by oligarchs. He had very complicated relations with radical opposition, and even with communists in parliament, because they thought that he is not very firm in many aspects. But he was pragmatic. He was flexible enough, but at the same time, he was firm enough. He was representing the new style of Russian diplomacy, and the Founding Act on mutual relations, cooperation and security between NATO and Russia, which was the first attempt to establish the new framework for relations between emerging Russian political system and the North Atlantic Alliance, was a product not only of the new approach of the West towards Boris Yeltsin's new administration, but it had a lot of influence of the ideas which Evgeny Primakov brought to Russian foreign policy and people who came with him. But what has happened in July 1997, right in 2 months after the Founding Act has been signed and adopted by two sides? I want to remind you that Founding Act is not a legal document. It's just declaration which NATO and Russia did together. In July of 1997, the session of NATO Council in Madrid has decided that first three former socialist countries, Poland, Hungary and Czech Republic, members of Visegrad Group, three members of Visegrad Group, not four, because in that time it was group of four already, could become full members of NATO. And this concept of different speeds of integration of former socialist countries into the Western security community has reached its practical resolution, because three countries which in that time perceived and has which have showed the highest level of readiness towards full membership in NATO showed their real capability to become members of NATO and have been perceived by NATO countries as candidates for full membership. In 1999, they have become members of NATO. And right after it, you remember what has happened and what dramatically changed relations between Russia and NATO, which were complicated till that moment, but didn't get into a serious crisis. What has happened? Kosovo crisis. And use of force by NATO in Yugoslavia without... there are different positions on it, but in Russia we prefer to say that without legitimate base of the UN Security Council resolution, because resolution which NATO used for the use of force was not mentioning the use of force. It mentioned other measures to resolve the conflict, but didn't mention any military measures. And I want to remind you that Russia supported this resolution of UN Security Council, but didn't support the idea of use of force. Do you remember which country was neutral during? During voting in the UN Security Council, do you remember?
China.
And what has happened then?
Since then?
With Chinese embassy in Belgrade?
Oh, it was bombed.
Mm-hmm. I see no connections, just facts. But anyway, it was sort of a demonstration for Chinese government of its different position, and it was demonstration for other countries that China is starting its own foreign policy towards Western community and is beginning to play a new role in the world order. Anyway, what has happened after, from many books and publications, Primakov made a decision, who was flying to the United States and wanted to have negotiations about situation in former Yugoslavia. He decided to turn his plane, and it caused a sort of a bomb explosion in the Russian domestic political environment, because liberals were criticizing him strongly. A lot of newspapers have published a lot of articles showing very extremely negative approach towards his decision. Why? Because Russia was highly dependent on Western credits in that time. And it was waiting for the decision of International Monetary Fund to the new cash flow coming to Russian economy and supporting supporting weak and economy which was still being in a serious crisis. I know personally some people who worked in Primakov's government in that time. For example, my boss, academician Dinkin, used to be his advisor in economy, and he told me, how many US dollars we had in Russian monetary fund? 80 millions of dollars. That was the only background for independent foreign policy in that time. And billions of credits, billions of dollars in credits. That's the paradox of Russian mentality. But anyway, it was decision-making process which has been supported also by Boris Yeltsin, who was very cautious and who understood that positive reaction on or any form of support towards decisions and actions by NATO in this situation can cause serious domestic political reaction. Because the major of society was absolutely against use of force in Yugoslavia. Even people who were standing on liberal positions, many of them, they were not supporting Western decisions in that time. And I think from this point, very serious contradictions between Russia and NATO in the understanding of forms and methods of use, not only of use of force, but also of organizing the security architecture in Europe started to be very, very different. And from this moment, I think crisis which has happened in Russian-NATO relations had a serious prolonged long-term effect on perception of NATO activity and NATO enlargement and further steps of developments of NATO policy in Eastern Europe and towards former Soviet republics. I think it was the first real crisis which really changed attitudes of many people in the Russian political elite towards NATO. Till this moment, some people had illusions that Russia can be integrated into NATO. Some people really believed that programs of partnership will one day lead to full membership for Russia, not only for Eastern European countries and former republics of the Soviet Union. A lot of people believed that there could be a balance of interests and and not military balance, of course, because in that time NATO has been already prevailing in terms of conventional weapons over Russia. But people believed in compromises with NATO. But from this point, the majority of Russian political elite has started to think in different categories. They understood that Russia cannot be really integrated into the Western security community. They understood that NATO is not, taking into account Russia in the decision-making process. And founding act, which Russia and NATO have signed, doesn't matter for decisions of even concerning use of military force. And it caused strong anti-NATO attitudes and strong anti-NATO political positions in Russian political elite, in Russian military, in Russian society in general. I think even Primakov's decision in that time has been perceived as not enough decision, because a lot of people in the military community, they suggested to send forces. For example, commander of naval forces, Admiral Kurayedov, in that time openly said that a Russian fleet is ready to go to the Mediterranean Sea to prevent the usage of battleships and aircraft carriers of members of Alliance from bombing and attacking Yugoslavia. It was absolutely different from official position, but it has been openly said by the commander of Russian fleet. Do you understand what was going on in Moscow in that time? I saw demonstrations in Moscow. I was a student in that time. I saw demonstration in front of American embassy. I saw how people were shocked with the use of force and how angry they were. Because, Dr. Ruzhansky today said a lot about identity. So for many Russians, Serbia has been a country identified with the role of Russia in Balkans and with the role of Russia as keeper and protector of Orthodox Christians in Balkans. And it has been perceived by the society, by the major of society, in this very historic context. That's significant for understanding Russia's reaction on crisis in Yugoslavia. What has happened after that? The second expansion of NATO in 2004, which included Baltic states into the process of enlargement of NATO, was also very sensitive, because psychologically it was a sort of a Rubicon for Russian government and for Russian political elites. If Baltic states, who of course were different from other republics of the Soviet Union and perceived in this way, have been perceived in this way by Soviet even, and even in Soviet times by Soviet and elite and the major of society, but if they could be integrated into Western military political structures, who could be the next? And George Bush administration named the next. In the Freedom Protecting Act of 2007, Ukraine and Georgia have been openly named among countries who can become NATO members in the future. And for Russia, it was a sort of a sign of Western approach towards Russian interests and the Russian vision of European security, and Russia felt itself excluded absolutely from the process of development of new security architecture in Europe in general. After that Bucharest summit decision was correlating with and more interconnected with Russian position, and European countries, they understood, and their governments, they understood the threat that Euro-Atlantic security community could face in the situation if Ukraine and Georgia would be integrated into NATO structures. But anyway, for Russia, it was, and for a major of Russian political elite, it was just a step behind, and it could be followed by the step forward if and when political situation could allow Georgia and Ukraine follow NATO. You know what has happened after that in Georgia, and why I think one of the reasons for Russian decision to use force in South Ossetia against Georgia, and it has been based not only on the fact of that some Russian peacekeepers died, not only on the fact that Ossetian diaspora in Russia has started its own mobilization and was trying to find weapons to go and fight in southern Ossetia, but it was mostly driven, the decision of Russian government, with the fact that if Russia will keep silence on Georgians' attempts to reunite South Ossetia into the, you know, sovereignty of Georgia, it would mean that the way towards membership in NATO for Georgia would be open, and it would give also opportunity for Ukraine to start the process. And you know, of course, I'm not justifying the use of force, but I'm trying to explain you how Russian government, Russian officials, Russian political elite perceived and understood the processes were going on in Eastern Europe in this period, and especially how they were concerned with possibility of NATO membership of Ukraine and Georgia, because NATO, since Yugoslavian crisis, since the use of force, have been perceived not as one of instruments and institutions of you know, preserving peace and stability in Europe, but it has been perceived as an instrument of Western politics and Western approach to this European security, which did not include any interests and any positions of Russian Federation. And till nowadays, each crisis in Russian-NATO relations has lasted not very long, but this crisis we're having now is still going on. And the paradox is that in the end of 1999, it was, and in the beginning of 2000, it was NATO who suggested to start dialogue again with Russia. And in 2008, I think in 3 months after Georgian crisis, it was NATO who suggested to restore dialogue with Russia on security issues and interaction. And I remember how in 2009 and from 2009 and till 2012, the period of so-called reset in Russian-American relations inspired different, you know, playgrounds and different attempts on track one, track two, track one half to establish new relations with between Russia and NATO, between Russia and the United States. And in that time, a lot of people in Moscow believed, okay, we have passed through two crises. We are facing the better understanding of mutual interests, where we are understanding interests of each other. Russia is not a weak country as it used to be in 1990s, so it should be taken into account by the West as a major player in Europe, and we can have compromises on many issues. And both sides, I remember it because I professionally I have been involved, like Dr. Rozhansky, in that process. In that time, a lot of people in military, political community, in the governmental circles in Moscow believed that we are facing a real opportunity to find compromises on many issues and to build new security architecture in Europe. But what has happened? Russia has suggested a so-called European Security Treaty. Of course, it was, you know, not very well prepared attempt, not very well prepared in terms of the ideas which this document included and brought to the table. It has been not prepared for diplomatically. And Russia didn't have any support from outside for this document. But it was an attempt driven by this, you know, aspirations of a big part of Russia, significant part of Russian political elite, because it was supported with track two activities, with track one half activities. And a lot of people believe that NATO members, the United States, are starting to understand Russian interests and starting to take them into account, and we can find compromise on European security, and we can think about new architecture which could include NATO, collective security organization, and some other institutions into the development of European security infrastructure. But when it failed because of domestic political reasons, both in Washington and Moscow, because electoral processes in both countries have started, and both governments were not interested in bringing these ideas and finding compromises in the case they were facing the necessity to demonstrate their strong positions on many issues for domestic political reasons. But anyway, it was the last attempt before the next crisis in Russian-American relations and Russian-NATO relations, and it was the last attempt before the most significant crisis of European security architecture we faced after events in Ukraine. So I'm finishing my lecture, and I want to finish it with one poem, which we didn't have any agreement of reading poems today. It suddenly, occasionally happened. But I want to read it. I will read it in Russian. This poem has been written by Iosif Brodsky, Nobel Prize winner in literature, one of icons of Russian liberal intelligentsia, Russian, you know, well-educated class of people, and he was in strong opposition towards Soviet government. He criticized a lot what was going on in Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union, but he was complete anti-communist, and he had very strong anti-imperial understanding of Russian foreign policy and security policy, and criticized strongly. But this poem illustrates how even liberal circles of Russian intellectuals perceived the opportunity for Ukraine to become a member of NATO, the opportunity of Ukraine to be integrated into Western military political structures. I'm very sorry, it is absolutely politically incorrect poem. I want to emphasize that this is not my position. This is position of the author. So, на независимость Украины. Иосиф Бродский, 94 год. Это стихотворение было написано, когда Украина стала участником программы «Партнерство ради мира». Дорогой Карл XII, который сегодня принес. Дорогой Карл XII, сражение под Полтавой, слава богу, проиграно. Как говорил Картавый, время покажет Кузькину мать. Руины, кости посмертной радости с привкусом Украины. То не зелено-квитный, траченный изотопом, то жовто-блакитный реет над конотопом. Скроенным из холста знать прислала Канада. Даром, что без креста, но хохлам не надо. Гой ты, рушник-карбованец, семечки в полной жмене. Не нам, кацапам, их обвинять в измене. Сами под образами 70 лет в Рязани с залитыми глазами жили, как при Тарзане. Скажем им звонкой матерью, паузы медля строго, скатертью вам хохлы и рушником дорога. Ступайте от нас в жупане, не говорите в мундире. По адресу на три буквы, на все четыре стороны. Пусть теперь в мазанке хором гансы с ляхами ставят вас на четыре кости, поганцы. Как в петлю лезть, так сообща, путь выбирая в чаще, а курицу из борща грызть в одиночку слаще. Прощевайте, хохлы, пожили вместе, хватит. Плюнут ли в Днепро, может, он вспять покатит, брезгуя гордо нами, как скорой битком набитой кожаными углами и вековой обидой. Не поминайте лихом, вашего хлеба, неба, нам подавись мы жмыхом и колобом не треба. Нечего портить кровь, рвать на груди одежду, кончилась знать любовь, коль была меж нами промежду. Как ковыряться зря в рваных корнях глаголом? Что ковыряться зря в рваных корнях глаголом? Вас родила земля, грунт чернозем с подзолом. Полно качать права, шить нам одно другое. Эта земля не дает вам, кого нам, покоя. Ой, да левада степь, краля баштан вареник. Больше поди теряли, больше людей, чем денег. Как-нибудь перебьемся. А что до слезы из глаза, нет на нее указа ждать до другого раза. С Богом, орлы-казаки, гетманы и вертухаи. Только когда придет и вам помирать, бугаи, будете вы хрипеть, царапая край матраса, строчки из Александра, а не брехню Тараса. That's something.